You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto Rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up. The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Your spring is about to get a lot more power with the Home Depot. Get gas-like power from mowing, trimming, and blowing with the Ryobi 18-volt OnePlus system starting at just $89. Mowing power that can take on a third of an acre with one charge. Trimming power with up to 2 hours of runtime. And blowing power with 110 miles per hour of clearing force. All in one interchangeable battery. Get cordless gas-like power for the entire lawn with the Ryobi 18-volt OnePlus system. Only at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to History of the Great War Revisited, Episode 2, The Anglo-German Naval Arms Race, Part 2, Tirpitz's Plan. This episode will continue to track the expansion of the Imperial German Navy. Last episode discussed the very beginnings of that navy, and then the arrival of Admiral Tirpitz as a leading figure in its further development. That episode then ended with a brief discussion of Tirpitz's risk theory. This episode will discuss the series of events in the last years of the 1800s and the first years of the 1900s, during which Tirpitz would take his theories and begin to turn them into reality. Just as a quick review, Tirpitz's risk theory was based around the idea that the Royal Navy, with all of its global commitments, could not risk a conflict with a large naval power in Europe. All that a European navy had to do was be large enough to present the risk of a large loss of British capital ships. And if it could do so, then the British would not and could not risk getting into a naval conflict with that navy, because to do so would be to risk the ability of the British to maintain their worldwide empire, which was more important than almost anything in Europe, at least according to Tirpitz. Tirpitz's goal was to build up the Imperial German Navy to a point of strength where it could present this risk. To do so meant that Germany had to start building ships, a lot of ships, and those ships would cost a lot of money, which meant that Tirpitz had to get political and public support for an expensive naval building program. While Tirpitz was good at many things, the detailed financial and political planning that was going to be required was not an area where Tirpitz was particularly strong. He knew what he wanted, and he could justify those beliefs, but he had little experience in the public arena of taking those beliefs and turning them into policy, and then gathering political and public support for that policy. Due to this inexperience, it was fortunate for the German Navy that in 1897, Tirpitz would meet Commander Edward von Kapell. Kapell would prove to be the perfect person to fill in some of the skill gaps that Tirpitz had, like fiscal policy. The two would work together for the next 17 years, all the way until Kapell retired in 1915. Their relationship would be perfectly described by German Admiral von Trotha, who would say, quote, "Kapell was at that time, because of his personality, a good moderating counterweight on the more freewheeling Tirpitz. He would listen quietly to Tirpitz's hard-driving plans without much response. Then a few days later, he presented, in a thoughtful and tactful way, the difficulties, financial and above all parliamentary, which the plans would meet. In the ensuing conversations, Tirpitz would then formulate the right policy." End quote. Kapell's role in determining the possible path forward was critical, because to build a large navy meant that Tirpitz needed public and political support, and he would need an almost endless supply of it. Tirpitz would also later discuss one of the ways in which Kapell would influence both the path of the Imperial German Navy and his own thinking. This is a good example of the type of advice that Kapell would give to allow the plans to work within the political reality of Germany at the time. Quote, this is Tirpitz again. "On Kapell's advice, I included a financial limit in the first Navy bill, as the raising of money offered no difficulties, for, as I've already said, the necessary means were at hand without taxation. This financial limit made the bill more palatable to the Reichstag, but it created difficulties for us afterwards in the administration of the bill because the value of money depreciated steadily. This is also a great introduction to the fact that, especially for the first 10 to 12 years of the naval building program, money would be the only thing that was really discussed. That was the only thing the Reichstag wanted to talk about. It was what Tirpitz and Capel constantly had to fight against. While the politicians would eventually be the group that would have to make the decision to finance the Imperial Navy, it would begin with the people. In June 1898, the German Navy League was created with the purpose of building up its membership and convincing the German people that a large navy was not only a good thing, but was actually essential for the future success of Germany as a nation. The League found financial backing from industrialists, who stood to gain a lot from large naval construction contracts. It was really the perfect storm of positive changes for all of the heavy industries in Germany. For example, Fritz Krupp would be one of the largest contributors to the German Navy League, and it was through the financial backing from industry that the League was able to reach a membership of 600,000 just 3 years after it had been created. While the German Navy League was technically independent of the German government and the Navy, it would still behave as a propaganda arm for Tirpitz and his plans. There was also an official propaganda group within the naval service called the Section for News and General Parliamentary Affairs. While the name would obfuscate its purpose a bit, the section was created to launch a propaganda campaign targeting the German people. As much of a role as he would have in the future developments of the German Navy, perhaps Tirpitz's greatest success was convincing the German people that they needed one at all. The country had, for all of its recent history, solely relied on its army and the conflict that was destined to happen on land. In the first years as the head of the German Navy, Tirpitz managed to convince enough citizens of Germany that they actually needed a large navy, and those citizens began to put pressure on the politicians in the Reichstag to make it happen. Beyond the relatively straightforward goal of building a bunch of warships, Tirpitz also had other objectives that he hoped to achieve that would help the German Navy sustain its growth and power. The army would always be the most important arm of the German military, and in the days of Bismarck, its funding structure had been changed to try and give it more autonomy and security. This change was put in place in 1893, and after that year, the funding model for the army had changed. Instead of having to request and justify funds every year, it was instead budgeted 5 years at a time. This presented a kind of stability that Tirpitz hoped to achieve because he believed that it was essential for long-term planning. If he could commit the German government to a multi-year building program, naval plans would not have to be constantly adjusted based on the yearly whims of politicians. This long-term planning was important based on the speed at which Germany could build warships. They would not be able to produce more than a few capital ships a year, at least initially, and so any large expansion of the German fleet would require measures that were measured not in years, but even in decades. This also meant that in the early years of the program, the German government would be spending a lot of money without a lot in return, other than a small handful of ships that were unable to challenge other naval powers. But if he could get long-term commitments, Tirpitz hoped that politicians would not be able to back out once the building started. The one problem that Tirpitz would have with these long-term funding lock-ins, which he would achieve quite well, was that he was not prepared for the rapid increase in naval costs. The long-term funding of the army worked out well because the army's costs were actually quite well known. There was some expansion and there were some technology changes, but the variance of costs of those changes was generally quite small. This was the complete opposite of what would happen for the Navy, where the costs of ships would skyrocket in the 20 years before the First World War. Tirpitz's initial plan would call for a building program that would last a decade, with the goal of having two squadrons of battleships at the end of the program. This would give Germany a total of 19 battleships, one fleet flagship, two squadrons of 8 battleships, and then 2 battleships in reserve. While this was the goal, Tirpitz would not draft the first naval law in a way that committed Germany to the full 19. Instead, he just asked for the commitment to build 11 battleships over the span of 7 years. This would result in a building tempo of 2-2-1-2-1-1-2, with that number of ships being laid down each year. This would give the German Navy 11 battleships at or near completion in 1905. This initial set of ships, which would eventually comprise the 1898 naval law, would cost an estimated 410 million German marks. Even this very large budget was only achieved by certain economies being introduced to lower the overall costs. For example, the number of German sailors brought into the Navy was actually decreased for many of those construction years, roughly cut by a third, to reduce salary, training, and supply costs. The German sailors were conscripts, and so it was relatively easy to kind of reduce the total brought in each year. More pertinent to our story, the battleships would be built with just 11,000-ton displacements. 11,000 tons might seem large, but by the standards of other navies sort of building ships around this time, it was quite small. As a point of comparison, the Canopus-class pre-dreadnought battleships of the Royal Navy, which would be laid down at around this same time, especially that the Germans were kind of planning for their ships, were a little over 14,000 tons, so about 3,000 tons more. This would be the first instance where Tirpitz would prioritize the number of ships over the quality and size of those ships, but it would not be the last. With the large cost of the construction program, Tirpitz was forced to give assurances that naval technology was leveling off. This was important because there was some concern that the ships that were being built from the program would be out of date quite quickly, which would force them to be replaced. If the ships would be considered top of the line longer, then the large initial investment would be more worthwhile. Now, Tirpitz would say that naval technology was leveling off. I'm not sure that Tirpitz actually believed that, and of course we know today that it could not have been further from the truth. Even the pre-dreadnought years of the early 20th century saw a lot of evolution, and then all of these ships that the Germans were planning to build from this 1898 naval law would largely be out of date before they were needed in 1914. One of the reasons that Tirpitz's political planning and maneuvering was so important, and the reason that the topic of budgets and spending was so important, was the odd setup of the German tax system. Before the First World War, and really up until the rise of Hitler in the 1930s, the German constituent states, so Bavaria, Prussia, Saxony, etc., had a large amount of autonomy within the country. For our purposes, the most important feature of this autonomy was around the tax system and how the federal government and the Reichstag obtained money. At this time, the army was not a German army, but instead was several armies that were controlled by the German constituent states. This is a structure that would remain into the First World War, which is why, for example, the Bavarian army would remain independent during the war. The navy, on the other hand, was truly a national navy, and that meant that it got its funding not from the states, but from the Reichstag. This was problematic because the taxing ability of the Reichstag had been intentionally handicapped by Bismarck. Bismarck was concerned that the Reichstag could damage the power of the individual states and the elites within those states that largely controlled the state governments. Therefore, he limited the federal income of Germany to be only tariffs, postal and telegraph services, and consumption taxes on things like alcohol and tobacco. Critically missing from this list is direct taxation of the German people. As the years went by, even the indirect taxes that the Reichstag could levy started to bring in far more money than expected, especially from tariffs, and so a further change was made, which would be known as the Frankenstein Clause. This was a law passed by the Reichstag whereby any federal income over 130 million marks would be sent to the states. Then the Reich government could request some of it to be returned, which was then called matricular contributions. With an annual cost of 56 million, the 1898 naval bill was heavily dependent on these matricular contributions for its funding, and this dependence would grow substantially as the total cost of the German naval program skyrocketed in the years that followed. This put Tirpitz in a rather unfavorable position. The best way for him to get the money that he needed for his construction programs was to allow the Reich to levy direct taxes, which the states would simply not allow. Any direct taxation would also be heavily criticized by various powerful groups throughout German society, particularly the Prussian nobility, which enjoyed many privileges around taxation, ruling out something like an income or inheritance tax, which would target wealthy Germans directly. And so the naval bills would have to constantly play a balancing game between what they wanted to request in terms of budget and what was possible. This would force the German Navy to be fiscally conservative, which would, for many years, result in the construction of ships that were strictly inferior to those of other countries, especially when compared to those of the Royal Navy.
Your spring is about to get a lot more power with the Home Depot. Get gas-like power from mowing, trimming, and blowing with the Ryobi 18-volt OnePlus system starting at just $89. Mowing power that can take on a third of an acre with one charge. Trimming power with up to 2 hours of runtime. And blowing power with 110 miles per hour of clearing force. All on one interchangeable battery. Get cordless gas-like power for the entire lawn with the Ryobi 18-volt OnePlus system. Only at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Almost as soon as the 1898 Naval Law came into effect, discussions would begin about alterations and expansions to its existing clauses. Tirpitz would later recall that, quote, "In the course of the summer of 1899, we realized that the supplementary estimates could not wait until the conclusion of the six-year limit, 1904, and we decided to bring them in at the latest of 1901 or 1902. But to arrange the annual estimates for 1900 in such a manner as to open the way for the supplementary bill and to announce at the same time that we intended to anticipate the latter by some years." End quote. The changes introduced to the original naval bill would be called a novell, which is just German for amendment. We're going to be using that word a lot in the coming episodes because the history of German naval policy during these years is just a long series of novels as the size and cost of the German fleet continued to increase. For the first novel, Tirpitz was hesitant. The alterations would allow for a much larger fleet to be created, expansion that was necessary due to the construction policies in Britain. However, Tirpitz's hesitancy meant that there would be some self-imposed financial limitations. But his final decision to pursue the novel was also driven by those same financial considerations. He would say, quote, "I was prompted to this decision for three reasons. The first was a parliamentary nature. We could not manage with the financial limit fixed in 1898, for we had underestimated the increase in the price of ships." End quote. The concern was that if he asked for too much, the request would be rejected, which would undo much of the previous work done since 1898. Not for the last time, in his quest for novels and expansion, Tirpitz was aided by the actions of the Royal Navy. In 1899, the British were deep in the Boer War, and as part of that conflict, they had blockaded Delgoa Bay in South Africa. This action was done to prevent the Boers from receiving supplies from other European countries, including the Germans. As part of this blockade, the Royal Navy seized three German ships, which were on their way to South Africa. Two of these ships were searched and then released. However, one of the ships would be held with accusations that it was carrying contraband. This would begin the Brunsrath affair, with Brunsrath being the name of the ship. Even though Lord Salisbury would eventually order the ship's release, offer compensation, and issue an official apology, the damage in terms of German public opinion was irreversible. This event occurred at the perfect moment for Tirpitz. He was about to ask the German people to support further expansion of the navy, and the British had just given him the perfect example of why Germany needed a stronger navy if it wanted to be taken seriously around the world. This would be cited as one of the three major reasons that Tirpitz would pursue the novel. He would say, quote, "The third and most important reason why the Foreign Office of those days under Bülow and I personally did not want to delay the new navy bill for some years was the altered international situation. Violence had been done to a few of our ships." End quote. These events and the discussion of the actions of the British did introduce an interesting wrinkle into the conversations around the novel. How directly should the British be named as a possible enemy? To quote Tirpitz, quote, "When working out the Second Navy Bill, we hesitated for a long time whether or not to bring the idea of the English menace into the preamble. I should have preferred to leave England out of it altogether, end quote. Tirpitz's concern was that if such a public declaration were made, it risked a British challenge at a time when the German fleet was ill-prepared to react to such a response. Tirpitz again here, quote, during the first years of the policy of encirclement, the English did not yet take the building of the German fleet seriously. They were convinced that no first-class fleet could be built with the small sums that were being expended. They considered that our engineering side was too underdeveloped and our lack of organizing experience too great, end quote. With every increase in the German building program, their risk was that it would cross some kind of arbitrary boundary with the British, and that would cause diplomatic problems. Or as Tirpitz would say, quote, the Navy Bill provided the first opportunity for a moderation of England's desire to destroy us, because it would not have been so easily satisfied once the fleet was completed. On the other hand, it goes without saying that the fact of our building a fleet was felt by England to be an encroachment upon her monopoly of the seas, and that in this respect, the building of the fleet made our diplomatic position more difficult, end quote. While Tirpitz was hesitant, sort of, to challenge the Royal Navy too directly, such a confrontation was of course being discussed among German naval leaders. As early as 1896, the possibility of a naval war with Britain was being planned for, or at least there were some operations that were being planned. These operations were not exactly inspiring due to the huge disadvantages of the German fleet in such a conflict. One of the ideas that was rated as having a better chance of success was simply to take all of Germany's available naval strength and, for lack of a better term, execute a suicide dive into the Thames estuary to cause as much damage as possible before being overwhelmed by the Royal Navy. None of the ships were expected to return, but it would at least allow them to cause some damage, which was never guaranteed in a fight on the open seas. This was the reality of the situation at the close of the century, and one of the reasons that the only real option available to German naval planners was to increase the rate at which construction was happening. On the British side, there were also plans for a naval war against Germany, with an Admiralty analysis in early 1900 stating, quote, after the first naval law, Germany would have 17 ships of the line and 4 heavy cruisers, but the British could bottle them up in port with 28 ships of the line and 8 heavy cruisers. And even if German forces could find some advantageous battles, Britain could easily replenish her losses from her extensive reserves. The blockade of the German coast would thus continue, regardless of any German successes. End quote. It is important to note, though, that the general belief among German naval leaders, even if they were planning for a possible war against Britain, was that war should be avoided at all costs. The chief of the Admiralty staff, Bushel, would state in 1902 that, quote, it is the task of our diplomacy to avoid war with England as long as our honor permits, end quote. He would then go on to outline what he expected a war with Britain to be like, which would involve German trade swept from the seas, and then an attack from continental allies which Britain would use to directly attack Germany. The final draft of the first novel, which would become the 1900 naval law, would basically double what the building goals of the Imperial fleet had been. Tirpitz would describe it like this, quote, the second and still more important reason in favor of the speeding up of our supplementary bill was of a technical and administrative nature. We had to try and build as many ships as possible every year. Our military object and the means at our disposal suggested 3 big ships a year as our rate of construction, end quote. The goal was not just to be able to build more ships per year, but also to build more ships in total. Under the new naval law, there would be another fleet flagship, 2 additional squadrons of 8 battleships each, and then an additional 2 in reserve. There would also be a doubling of the number of cruisers and destroyers. This would all cost a total of 1.3 billion marks, and would add about 81.6 million to the annual budget. And that was just the cost of the new construction, and did not take into account any of the costs associated with the expanded navy. These costs included maintenance of the ships, the manning and training of the crews, and also the improvements to docks, harbors, and construction facilities that were required to support that many ships. When the cost of these items were added to the 1.3 billion construction costs, the total would actually be about $3.7 billion, which was a lot. This was large, but would be spread out over several years, and even though it was large, the passage of the amendment was never seriously in doubt. Tirpitz and Capel would not have submitted it if passage was not assured. It would reach the budget committee, which, after some discussions, decided to enact a tariff on wine, brandy, and champagne to help defray the costs. The one meaningful change requested by the Reichstag was that instead of being just an amendment to the 1898 law, the previous one should just be repealed due to some of the details and complications that had been included in the earlier legislation that I'm not going to dig into and probably are not worth caring about. The 1900 Naval Law would prove to be the longest standing of all of the naval laws passed by the Reichstag before the war. For the following 6 years, Tirpitz would attempt to obey its constraints, which were primarily of a financial variety, even though the cost of construction would continue to increase. He believed that it was important so that the naval program was not questioned on an annual basis. He still had to go back to the Reichstag every year to get the next year's budget approved, but as long as he stayed within the general confines of the 1900 estimates, this was an easy process. It was a rubber stamp process. His concern was that if he went much larger than the budgets previously allotted to the Navy, then the political leaders might begin to question the program as a whole, which could be very problematic for the future of the Navy. Tirpitz understood that he could only achieve his goals if he maintained the support of the political leaders, and so in these early years of construction, he spent much of his time and energy trying to stay on their positive side. However, events in Britain would eventually force his hand, and another Nouvelle would be put in place in 1906, conversations for which would begin as early as 1901. These conversations began due to the same type of concerns that had first caused changes to be discussed to the original naval law, and it was really about how many battleships were being built. Under the 1900 construction program, there would be a 3 tempo for battleship construction, so 3 would be laid down every year until 1906, and that year the tempo would drop to 2. Another problem that the next Nouvelle would seek to address was the increasing cost of ship construction. As ships got more and more powerful, they were also becoming increasingly more expensive. In 1900, the cost of each battleship was set at just 18 million marks. The Nouvelle sought to increase this to 20 million. Quite an increase, but one required due to the changes in ship construction costs. Capel initially suggested that a Nouvelle be made that would add 5 additional battleships and 4 additional cruisers, and these 5 battleships would be built in the years after 1906, which would extend the 3 tempo all the way to 1911. These would then be earmarked for service overseas with German colonies. However, Tirpitz remained hesitant to introduce these changes for the same reasons he wanted to try and always stay within the agreed-upon budget. Tirpitz's reluctance to go to the Reichstag to try and get more money for more ships caused conversations to shift. Other changes would begin to be discussed in 1904, these being prompted actually by the Kaiser. After returning from some of his travels around Europe, the Kaiser wanted to increase the tempo at which construction was occurring. Instead of a 2 tempo, he wanted a 4 tempo that would last from 1906 to 1909. This would allow for the completion of another squadron of battleships much sooner. Along with this increased tempo, the battleship lifespan would be decreased to 20 years, which would require a faster tempo in the future to keep numbers up, but would result in a newer navy in the coming decades. This is a great example of a time when the Kaiser's strong support for the expansion of the Imperial Navy actually caused some problems for Tirpitz. He was, at least from Tirpitz's and Capel's perspective, being far too bold and pushing too hard for expansion beyond what the Reichstag and the people would support. In this case, Tirpitz would be the voice of reason, talking the Kaiser down from his massively increased tempo and even the idea of building a 3rd double squadron of battleships. But these conversations with the Kaiser and Tirpitz's reluctance did not end the movement towards a 1906 Nouvelle, because events would eventually force a 1906 Nouvelle, although it would be very different than what was expected in even 1904. The root of the 1906 Nouvelle was not in Berlin, but in London, because the German building program, and not for the last time, would force a reaction from the British, a reaction that we will discuss in much greater detail in the next 2 episodes. However, it's important to consider what the Germans believed about the British position, and especially its diplomatic situation with other countries. Core to the German belief in 1900 was that the British and French would never be able to fully resolve their differences and work together. This was critical for the German Navy because the French were the 2nd largest navy in the world in 1900, and if they were possible enemies of the British, then a large portion of the Royal Navy's thinking and resources had to be dedicated to the French threat. However, in 1904, the British and French would sign an official agreement of understanding that seemed to turn the long-term rivals into something very close to friends. This allowed the Royal Navy to focus more of its strength against other possible enemies, like, say, the Germans. This would completely wreck Tirpitz's risk theory calculations, and it would cause the danger zone, during which the German Navy was not strong enough to present enough of a risk to the British, but were large enough to be of a concern, far into the future. This change in the geopolitical situation and an increase in building from the British meant that if risk theory was to be pursued, the Germans needed more ships, which meant they had to get that 1906 Novelle, it had to be formulated correctly, and it had to ensure that the Germans were ready for a possible British challenge. We'll discuss the 1906 Novelle in a later episode. Before we end this episode, though, I want to spend a bit of time discussing the ships that were being built under the 1898 and 1900 naval laws. I think it's important to discuss these now, because they're kind of forgotten in history. While they were top-of-the-line ships at the time, they would quickly be made obsolete by the Dreadnought and future ships of that type, and none of them would see action during the First World War. The important part to understand is that in the late 1890s, the idea of what a battleship was and should be had in many ways settled down to the definition that it would be until 1906. This was a big change from the 1880s and before, during which there was a lot of ambiguity around what a battleship was and how it should be built. There were many problems involved with gunnery, and specifically making guns large enough and accurate enough to handle the amount of armor that was being placed on board ships. This resulted in several ship generations where there was a belief that ramming might actually be the best method for ships to use in combat. That sounds completely absurd to us today, and probably would have in 1914 as well. But during the time period, the engagement ranges possible by naval guns was generally less than 800 meters. It would only be during the 1890s that the distances would really begin to stretch out. Even as gunnery became a greater emphasis, it would take several years before ships began to mount large numbers of large guns. There were also other technological innovations during this time that shifted battleship construction in big and small ways. For example, changes in the process of creating armor plate, particularly the introduction of nickel steel into armor plate design, allowed for a reduction in the thickness of armor plate without compromising its protective abilities. This allowed for more of the ships to be protected by armor while also reducing the total weight of that armor. For German ship design, this meant that the Brandenburg class of battleships, which immediately preceded the Wittelsbach class, had 400 millimeters of armor, while the Wittelsbach class, again built directly after, had only 225 millimeters of armor, which represented a substantial savings in total weight dedicated to that armor. They could go from 400 millimeters to 225 millimeters and get the same protection. The Germans would remain as one of the world leaders in armor plate design for much of the early 1900s. Another key innovation would be the introduction of chromium and manganese into the creation of that armored plate, which when combined with new production techniques, allowed for a much greater surface hardness while maintaining the proper elasticity at the back of the plate. This production technique would be called Krupp cemented armor, and it was soon used by all navies to produce even better armor plate. Some of these innovations would be included in the first ships built after 1898, which were the Wittelsbach class. These would mount four 24-centimeter guns, or a 10-inch gun, if you're American or British, although they would have a large number of smaller calibers. At the same time, the British were only using 28-centimeter or 11-inch guns on their ships, so 10 to 11, pretty similar. It's interesting to see that even at this very early date, the disadvantage in German caliber of guns is already present, and it would never really go away. Even with some of the challenges that were faced during their construction, the Wittelsbach class represented an important jump in German shipbuilding, prompting the Kaiser to say at the launching of the Wittelsbach that, quote, "No great decision may now be made without the German Empire and the German Emperor." The next class of German battleships, the Braunschweig class, would be laid down in 1902, and they would up their guns to 28-centimeter guns, but by that point, the British were already on 30.5 centimeter. The last German pre-dreadnoughts, which would be the ill-timed Deutschland class, would have the same 28 centimeter guns, while the British would stick with their 30.5 centimeter on their similarly timed Lord Nelsons. There was a good amount of controversy in Germany due to concerns that the Germans were wasting their time and money building ships that were inferior to their British counterparts. This would lead to the question of why bother building them if they were inferior? This was Tirpitz's greatest fear, and he would fight against that mindset throughout the entire expansion period. Tirpitz favored quantity over quality, and that's how he would always sort of structure his building programs, favoring having the maximum number of ships even if it meant reducing the overall size, expense, and power of each individual vessel. This would later prove to not be one of Tirpitz's mistakes, and even though the German capital ships were built with a different set of priorities, they were often not markedly inferior, even if their guns were generally smaller than their British counterparts, and even though they were making different design decisions in some ways. In relation to the events of the First World War, one item that was largely omitted from Tirpitz's plans during the first two naval laws, and I haven't even said the word up to this point in this episode, was submarines. Most of this come down to Tirpitz's personal belief on the role that submarines would play in a future war. Early in Tirpitz's building programs, submarines played essentially no role. Tirpitz did not believe that they would be worth the time, material, or money to build. In Tirpitz's defense, the early submarines, at around the turn of the century, were a new and somewhat crude technology. His greatest concern was the short range of the early submarines. He would later say, quote, "I refused to throw money away on submarines so long as they could only cruise in home waters, and therefore be no use to us." Because of this viewpoint, very little money would be spent on developing either submarine designs or production capacity, although in the years immediately before the war, this would begin to change and more U-boats would be built. And even when this began to change, it was less down to a change of heart in Tirpitz and more an admission that the public and official pressure around U-boats was simply too great. It got to the point where Tirpitz couldn't keep saying no. Tirpitz would then spin his views and actions a bit in his later memoirs, saying that, quote, "As soon as seagoing boats were built, however, I was the first to encourage them on a large scale, and in spite of the financial restrictions imposed upon me, I went as far as the limits of our technical production would permit," end quote. In essence, Tirpitz was taking the sure path to power, big ships and big guns, even though there was another navy that already had a monopoly on that space, the Royal Navy. We will discuss the Royal Navy next episode and try to determine why, at the turn of the century, the Royal Navy was actually looking not so great.